Hey, it's Rohan. Throughout your week, it's important to find moments of inspiration to keep you empowered and uplifted. Lately, I've turned to How to Be a Better Human from TED, a podcast about the little things you can do to improve your life. Each week, comedian Chris Duffy has refreshing and honest conversations with experts that can help you look at life differently. From cleaning your house to having a healthier relationship with work. So check out How to Be a Better Human wherever you get your podcasts. Alex Honnold is one of the most celebrated rock climbers in the world. Known for being the only person to summit El Capitan in a free solo ascent. That is, without any ropes. Undoubtedly, Alex knows how to do hard things. Yet he's also had to learn that his drive to push himself will only take him so far. In today's episode, Alex tells the story of how he's come to understand the importance of reading the conditions of the environment and learning to adapt. From Wait What, this is Meditative Story, where immersive first-person stories and mindfulness prompts inspire you to reflect on your inner life. I'm Rohan, and I'll be your guide. The body relaxed. The body breathing. Your senses open. Your mind open. Meeting the world.
I open my eyes and look around my backpacking tent. The flaps of the tent have frosted overnight, like someone sprinkled climbing chalk from above. I'm wrapped up in my dad's old sleeping bag. It's like a cocoon, warm, cozy. Only my face is exposed, but my face is freezing. I watch each breath condense instantly into frost. The tent I'm using is meant for spring, summer, and fall, but it's January. I think about starting my day, and I feel lazy. I don't want to unzip the sleeping bag and go out into the cold, but that's the only way to start my day of climbing, and that's what I came here to do. I'm 20 years old and I recently dropped out of college, a year after my dad died. I opted out of school so I could be fully committed to climbing. This is my chance to do the thing that I've read about my whole life, like one of my heroes, the alpinist and climber Dean Potter. It feels like I'm on a grand adventure, but I don't think of it as a vacation. If I'm not in classes anymore, and if I have no other plans, I better be climbing every day. I'm dedicating myself to doing cool things, so I better go out and do them. I rip the sleeping bag open and reach for my water bottle. A tiny trickle of water comes out, but it's mostly frozen solid. Then I rifle through my backpack for a blueberry muffin, but it's also mostly frozen. I bite at its thawed edge while putting on my shoes. I go into autopilot to get myself ready for the day of climbing. There's no point in delaying. I can be uncomfortable now, or I can regret delaying later. There's a cost either way, and I'll forget the physical discomfort soon enough. So I push myself. I step out of the tent and zip it up behind me. When I straighten up, I take a deep breath of frigid air and look out at the snow-capped mountains in the distance. I'm at the Pit, a campground outside of Bishop, California, on the east side of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Elevation 4,000 feet. There's several feet of snow all around me. The except for the blank spaces where other tents used to be. Everyone else cleared out weeks ago, after the first major snowfall. I'm one of the few people staying here through the winter. I'm mostly alone. I cross the quiet campground and pass a big brown bulletin board full of old notices. I find my bike where I parked it yesterday afternoon. My dad's old green mountain bike. It groans as I pedal it out of the campsite. For years, I've used this bike to commute around the suburbs to and from the climbing gym. But now I'll be riding it 20 miles up a pass to the cliffs. My hands feel frozen to the handlebars. I've always been bad about using gloves. Soon I'm biking down the shoulder of California 395. The road is sweeping, straight, and long. It takes me half an hour to reach the turnoff where I exit onto a parallel service road. To my right is a giant chasm. Like a mini Grand Canyon that drops 400 feet down to a river that's carving its way through the plateau. The cliffs on the other side of the river are compressed volcanic ash, welded together into these cool, jagged columns. Piles of white snow contrast with the pink in the rocks. To my left, the Sierra Crest towers 10,000 more feet above me. The granite ridges extend endlessly in every direction. It's epic. The road is steep. I push and push as I slowly grind up the hill. It takes an hour more, but finally, I pull off to the side of the road and park my bike on the rim of the canyon. I pause for a moment to plan out what's next. From here, I have to hike down a steep gorge and scramble down snow and rock. Only then will I get to the cliffs that I came here to climb. This has been my routine for the last few weeks, though some days I'm so tired from the ride here that I sit at the bottom of the cliffs, eat my lunch, and then hike back out. It's hard to push myself to do this every day, but I know how to do hard things. I know how to practice pushing my limits. I just think about how any day I take off is a day of progress wasted, and it motivates me to push forward. That's how I challenge myself, and that's why I'm here. My hands and feet grip the rough surface of the steep stone face in front of me. I'm hanging 150 feet off the ground, or maybe it's 70 feet. I'm not really sure, but it's high enough that it's serious. I'm free soloing, rock climbing without a rope or belay. It's one of my favorite ways to climb, because it puts me in a mindset to have big thoughts about life and to confront mortality and fear. But I'm starting to feel fear right now, because I'm beginning to realize that I might be off route. For the past 20 minutes, I've been trying to reconcile what's around me with what I'm supposed to be doing. Am I on the right route? I scan around as I move up and right. And then I see it, a little above me, a glint of metal, a bolt, a piece of protection left in place for climbers to attach the ropes to as they ascend. But I'm not using any ropes. And there aren't supposed to be any bolts on the route that I think I'm climbing. So I'm definitely on the wrong route. Usually I'm confident when I'm free soloing because I plan out my route up the rock ahead of time. But now I've somehow drifted 200 feet away from my planned route, and I have no idea what my next set of moves should be. My climb just became a lot more uncertain. I jam my hand into a nearby crack and balance my toes onto small holds protruding from the granite. I can feel my body constrict, my muscles tighten. I look down toward the ground where I started my climb. Whoa. That's a long way down. I'm not sure how or if I can get back to the route that I thought I was on. So I have to keep going. I start just trying moves, hoping that if I get to a section that I feel like I can't do, I can always reverse. But for now, I'll try the next move and see, and then the one after that. And if any of them are too difficult, I can try to turn around. Climbers need to be graceful and fluid, but as I tense up, my movements become jerky and tweaky. I feel less steady than I should be, making my way up the face. Then, I reach the top, and I'm relieved. I know it could have gone better. When you're soloing and you start to get scared, your world contracts. I need to be able to stay relaxed, just so I can see everything around me. I was able to make it up because I can do hard things. I've trained for that. But I need to be able to stay relaxed so I can take in my whole environment.
How do you relate to this idea of staying relaxed while doing hard things? And given that this image of Alex climbing is itself quite a tense one, do what you need to do to relax right now.
My friend Colin Haley and I are thousands of feet up a granite spire in Patagonia, two or three pitches from the summit of a mountain named Cerro Torre. It's nighttime. The wind is insanely strong. We can't see the stars. It's not raining yet, but the weather got bad sooner than it was forecasted. We've been going for nearly 24 hours straight and already scaled three icy peaks. This is our last one. The summit is only a few hundred feet away. If we make it up and over the top, we can rappel down the southeast ridge back to our camp at the base. But it's midnight, and it's cold. And Colin knows what he's doing in icy environments, and he tells me that it's too dangerous to continue in these conditions. But we haven't come all this way just to give up at the first sign of trouble. We're so close to the end of this climb. If we wait, maybe the wind will subside and allow us to continue. So we hunker down. Colin and I are anchored from a sheet of ice. We hang off a rope that's tied into two ice screws. The harnesses that we're in make these little seats, like we're sitting on chairs that float in midair. Our feet dangle, skittering against the ice. It's really, really windy. The gusts buffet us against the wall over and over. I feel Colin shivering. Earlier in the day, when it was still sunny, he led a few hundred feet of ice climbing and got soaking wet in the process. For the next 5 hours, we have to hold each other for warmth as we wait for the sun to come back up. There isn't much to talk about. It's a pretty grim night. After what feels like an eternity, we finally start to see a tiny sliver of dawn. A little bit of light. It's just enough visibility for us to fully take in the situation at hand. Oh no, Colin and I say at the same time. In the dark of night, we could imagine that conditions weren't that bad. But now as dawn is breaking, there's no room left to pretend. We can see the black clouds everywhere. The clouds hang heavy and dark. It feels like they're about to swallow us, and the wind shrieks as it rips over the top of the mountain. It's even scarier now. We gotta get out of here, Colin says. A part of me wants to push through, to roll the dice. It's only a little bit more to the summit, and then we can get down and go straight back to camp and be comfortable. Maybe we can do the hard thing even in these tough conditions and at least complete the climb. But Colin walks me through his thinking. He tells me that these last few hundred feet aren't doable in these conditions. They're the hardest of the entire route. But we can't retreat down the north face either. No one's ever done that before. So the safest option, Colin tells me, is for us to go down the west side of the mountain and then walk all the way around the mountain range. I look at Colin, then at the swirling black clouds, then back again. Colin's climbed these mountains more than any other human. He's the most experienced person in the world in this type of terrain. It doesn't matter what I want or think. Like the weather itself, there's not much I can do right now other than support Colin. The choice is his. There's room for grit and perseverance in climbing, but there's also room for patience and humility, for honing that intuition that says, I have no more control over this. I need to retreat. I tell Colin, whatever you think is best. So down the west side we go. It's one continuous sheet of ice the whole way down. We can basically rappel straight down, and there's nothing for our ropes to get stuck on. I take two ice screws and drill them into the ice until they touch each other in the back, creating a V. Then we thread our ropes through the V and rappel down from this little triangle of ice. Down 200 feet, drill again. Down 200 feet, drill again, for thousands of feet of vertical ice. One of our ropes has a little hole in it, and each time that section of rope is about to pass through my belay device, I gently inch it through so that it doesn't tear completely. Eventually, we make it to the bottom, where we begin our long march around the mountains. Our food was gone hours ago. We open wrappers and try to lick the insides. We shake out plastic to get one more little crumb of cheese. It takes us another 20 hours of hiking to finally stumble back to town. I'm tired, ready to pass out, but I also feel proud. We set out to do a record-breaking 24-hour traverse of the four spires in this mountain range. We ended up climbing 3.9 spires and spending 54 hours out having an epic survival experience. We retreated because it was the smart thing to do. We gave it everything we could. We couldn't have done any more. And because of that, when we made the decision to turn back, we knew that it was because the conditions just weren't good enough. The only way I can keep trying these things, the only way I can keep pushing my limits, is if I can tell when I shouldn't push any further. If I accept that no matter how much I train and prepare, there will always be things beyond my control.
In this moment, there are things we can control, like the rhythm of our breathing. But there's a lot we can't. When we face things we can't control, how can we find acceptance and learn to adapt?
I wipe down the kitchen counter with a damp cloth. I stack the plates from last night's dinner in the dishwasher, add some detergent, and run it. I look over to my left at June, my 2-year-old daughter. Her hair is coming in, blonde and wispy. She roams around exploring the kitchen as I clean. She's incredibly cute, and mischievous too. She runs up to me, her footsteps tiny but furious, holding a pair of my sandals that she places at my feet. "Dada's shoes! Dada's shoes! Outside!" she insists, pointing. We have a few more things to do inside, but I'm used to these little detours, when June becomes fascinated or excited about something. Yesterday she spent 15 minutes in the car, rolling the windows up and down. "Do you want to put on your boots?" I ask. "Crocs!" she shouts. June loves her little yellow Crocs, but they're not particularly waterproof. "Are you sure you don't want the boots? They'll be warmer and drier. Your feet are going to be cold in the Crocs." But June insists, "Crocs!" I shrug. She's about to get her socks soaked and her pants wet. I'm going to have to change her diaper. But who cares? I'll always keep June safe, stop her from making big mistakes. But she's 2. I can't push a toddler to see reason any more than I can climb in inclement weather. It's beyond my control. My job is to keep her safe, keep her growing, and let it all unfold. To be patient and to accept the current conditions. I call it downstream parenting. Going with the flow. When we get her Crocs on and step outside, June exclaims, "Whoa! Puddle!" Our kitchen door leads out to a breezeway where we park the car. It's flat and concrete. Annoying for adults when it rains, but June is very excited about the puddle. She runs into it. She's fired up, splashing around. Each time she lands, I see water flood her Crocs. But she's so happy, so I am too. We all encounter times when we need to push ourselves. But the more I push as a climber, and the more I figure out what it means to be a dad, the more I realize the need to let things unfold. I'm less hardcore, more relaxed. If I try to impose rigid boundaries on June, I miss the joy of her exploration. If I try to climb when it's too dangerous, I might miss the opportunity to try again later. If I hold on too tight, I'm not necessarily more safe. Life will give you chances to pursue things that are difficult to do. Sometimes you need to push yourself to make it through. But other times, you need to wait it out or turn back. As you push your limits, relax. Be patient. Read the conditions at hand and adapt to whatever emerges in the grand adventure of life.
Thank you, Alex. I really love the theme that Alex points to in his story. That of being adaptable, of knowing when to retreat, when to relax, when other parts of us want to push on. It's a dance and a skill. Only do the relaxy bit, and that's all we know. Only do the pushing on bit, and we can frustrate others and burn out, or worse. I've been there in my own meditation practice. There was a time many years ago when I was really pushing myself, climbing the meditation equivalent of a sheer rock face, and I tried so hard, had so much tightness and doggedness that I just burned out. What I'd mistaken for wise determination was actually just lack of a more holistic awareness. What Alex calls not taking into account my wider environment. As I was reflecting on this tension, my awareness dropped into my breath. Yes, a cliche, but hey, it happened. And as I did that, I actually noticed a metaphor for Alex's story in the breath. So let's explore it together. Pushing ourselves and stepping back. Pushing ourselves and stepping back. The in-breath and the out-breath. The in-breath and the out-breath. So take your time and drop your awareness into the breath as it is here and now. Knowing your in-breath, knowing your out-breath. No rush, just take your time. Now, in particular, we're interested in the crest of the breath, this tiny foothold for our attention. The moment where the in-breath can go no further and the out-breath kicks in. See if you can locate this spot at the top of the breath, where the in-breath turns into the out-breath. Aware of it across a few cycles of the breath. Getting really into knowing what that crest, that tiny foothold, is like. can you sense the tension in that micro moment where the breath can't go on? And then the release of dropping back. In mindfulness and other kinds of self-development and self-care practices, we do need that intention and drive to climb the rock faces of our lives. But there can be a high cost to not being able to adapt to how real life, real conditions, and real people meet our constructed plans. In parts of the mindfulness tradition, you often hear the metaphor of the two wings of the bird, two qualities that you have to balance to fly. Normally, it's other words used, but today, thanks to Alex, the qualities we're being invited to balance are drive and adaptability. Drive and adaptability. On behalf of the team at Meditative Story, thank you for spending time with us today. We love creating the show for you. And if the show serves you in a meaningful way, we'd love to hear from you. Would you take a minute right now to write us a review in your podcast app? When you leave a review, it really inspires our team. And we're a group who derives so much energy from understanding how Meditative Story impacts you. It's also a way for you to pay it forward by helping others discover the show. So if leaving a review speaks to you today, we'd really appreciate it. So thank you, Alex. And of course, thank you, June. And of course, thank you. Go well. We'd love to hear your personal reflections from Alex's episode. How did you relate to his story? You can find us on all your social media platforms through our handle at Meditative Story. Or you can email us at hello@meditativestory.com. Meditative Story is a Wait What original. Our executive producer is Jay Punjabi. The series is produced by Dorothy Abrams. Our VP of music is Ryan Holiday. Original music and scoring by Eduardo Rivera. Our script writers are Marie Kilaru, Dan Neelin, Florence Williams, and Nadav Ziv. Mixing and mastering by Brian Pugh. Wait What was co-founded by June Cohen and Darren Triff. Special thanks to Sarah Tarter, Mariel Carica, Kay Rugg, Nikki Williams, Tim Cronin, Sammy Oputa, Louisa Velez, Colin Howarth, Brandon Klein, Brad Whirl, Timothy Lu Lee, and Dave Fisher. And I'm Rohan Gunatilaka, creator of Mindfulness Cards and the all-new Mindfulness Cards for the Family, and your host. Visit meditativestory.com to find the transcript for this episode. Thank you.